This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about the new book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States.
From the start, it was imperialism, from sea to shining sea.
We'll also hear from attorney Geeta Schwartz from the Center for Constitutional Rights. She brings us an update on the federal lawsuit, Hassan v. City of New York. It challenges the constitutionality of the NYPD spying on the Muslim community for over one decade. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
In the United States today, there are more than 500 federally recognized indigenous communities and nations comprising nearly 3 million people. These are the descendants of the 15 million people who once inhabited this land and are the subject of the latest book by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. In An Indigenous People's History of the United States, Dunbar Ortiz challenges the founding myth of the United States and shows how policies against the indigenous peoples were genocidal and imperialist, designed to crush the original inhabitants. Spanning more than 300 years, this classic bottom-up history significantly reframes how we view our past. Told from the viewpoint of the indigenous, it reveals how Native Americans for centuries actively resisted expansion of the U.S. empire. We're joined now by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Welcome, Roxanne, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
We wanted to start by posing a question that you yourself actually raise in the book, namely, how might acknowledging the reality of U.S. history work to transform society?
Well, one friend of mine, a young historian who teaches Navajo students in Arizona in a rural school, I think said it best that it's not sufficient but necessary to make a movement in the United States and actually change the world. It's absolutely necessary to know this history of settler colonialism and how it affects consciousness today of U.S. people and in the world, because everyone is convinced of this myth of the United States. And somehow it's always just going off the path of this destiny that has never been true in the first place. You know? So it's like a fairy tale, and only it's extremely deadly and dangerous, unlike stories you just tell for excitement or whatever. And many other countries have romantic myths as their form of nationalism, but they don't control the world with this ideology.
And what are some of those myths specifically?
Well, the myth is that it was a birth of democracy. It was a birth of settler democracy. But we know, say, from apartheid South Africa, we know from colonialism, but particularly settler colonialism, such as Israel, that this idea of being destined, the settler destiny. In fact, there are so many parallels with Israel because the Puritans, and then this became embedded in all settlers, had this idea of the New Jerusalem, of Zion. They used that terminology that God had given them this land to settle. It wasn't just a right, it was a responsibility to destiny, to the world. So this was a core idea. This made, of course, transforming the native farmers, fishermen, ordinary people like other people in the world into savages and monsters, sort of like the Israelis do Palestinians today. It's kind of odd that I find in explaining U.S. history that people know more about Israel and Palestine than they do about U.S. history. So I can bring up these examples and then it kind of clicks. Oh, yeah, it's very similar. You know, if you look at the maps of the shrinkage of native land compared to Israel, and you know, and our most of us remember, you know, from that time, or I was 10 years old when Israel was found. So it's a reality, but it's just history when it comes to the United States. It's gone, it's done, but it's not. It feeds into, throughout the book, I have a theme of the militarism and the counterinsurgency, which attacks civilians and food fight, they call it, burns the food supplies, the crops, burns the houses of the people in their towns, creates refugees, that this then becomes a pattern. Richard Slotkin calls it a regeneration through violence, that every generation there's this Indian war. Vietnam looked like an Indian war. Even the language they use, Indian country for enemy territory, all of the weapons they name after Native people. This carries on. I mean, it gets a little bit psychological, but it has the material base of imperialism and accumulation and power and control. But it's also deeply militaristic, unlike any empire before it, that almost compulsively militaristic. And this is not how we think of the United States as supposedly a civilian country. The military is always under control of civilians. But that civilian president is commander-in-chief of the armed forces. You know, that's not common. The prime ministers of most countries are not the commanders-in-chiefs of the armed forces.
Yeah, well, we've had a tenure discussion on that since right after 9/11. It's a problem to have a democratic country when the president is also the general. Right. And you can see it now, of course, with Syria. But let me get back to the settler colonial enterprise that was launched when the Puritans set foot in Massachusetts. And talk to us about what kind of society these Europeans found on this continent. How many people lived here? What was their culture like? How did it compare to Europe, say, west of the Ural Mountains? What was it like, and what did they do to it?
Well, this is the mythology, is to reduce the population to either non-existent or Neolithic hunters roaming around in untouched forests. Whereas it's the exact opposite, is out of 9 centers of civilization, that is agricultural, the development of agriculture and being able to support large population, 3 of those are in the Americas, the Andes, actually 4, the Andes, central Mexico, and the southeast and northeast of North America. And there's also a theory of the Bering Straits, only one entrance to the whole continent, which is absurd because all of the people on the coast were great seafaring people. It's odd that we know in the Pacific everyone was all over the place in boats, you know, populating all the islands. But somehow all those people along the coast of the Pacific or Atlantic, just they were afraid of the water or something, you know. They weren't out there exploring or going to India or Africa and vice versa. So a part of European imperialism, say, is the beginning of everything, you know, that it connected people up. And actually what it did was separate people from each other and their traditional. But the most impressive thing for me doing this research, I knew my specialization is the Southwest and Central Mexico, Central America. And everyone knows that's you can't really deny the pyramids and the great cities that 30 million people in central Mexico, whereas there were only 50 million people in all of Europe up to the Ural Mountains, or 30 million just in central Mexico, and 100 million in the whole hemisphere. So I knew there were complex trade routes and roads all over the place. Canals, you know, irrigation canals, highly developed agriculture. But to learn, and in this first chapter, Follow the Corn, I did just that. I followed out of Mexico this dispersion of corn agriculture all the way to Tierra del Fuego and to the subarctic, and from coast to coast, agricultural civilizations. What was different about them, which is very interesting, is that the idea of Oriental despotism, that when, you know, great civilizations and cities develop, that class systems develop. Marx adopted that idea of Oriental despotism. But they didn't know really anything about the cultures of the Americas. And what you find in the Americas is when they get to the point of, say, abusing the environment, of becoming dictatorial or whatever, there tends to be revolts that overthrow those. That was happening when Cortez came to Mexico, the Quetzalcoatl cult that took over the Mexico government, the Aztec government, became abusive, and it was doing slave raiding, had done a wonderful job of dispersing all kinds of trade routes. And so there was a Cortez simply allied with the rebels and overthrew the central government. Of course, they couldn't have known his intentions of simply wiping out their whole civilization. And
can you talk a bit, Roxanne, about the commodification of land?
Yes, this is, of course, land in the Americas was whatever the, there were hundreds of different kinds of polities and governance and arrangements, but in all cases, and I think this was true of the whole world, not just the Americas, it's collective land ownership. It's more practical. It's more brings people together. It takes a burden off, you know, a certain class of people just doing all the work. It just makes for better democratic principles. So I think it was kind of common sense to human beings. But with this, you know, and I think, you know, no one better than Marx brings, the understanding of capitalism being a more recent development. But in the United States, I mean, clearly there was the accumulation of capital, the prior accumulation of capital with the looting of the Americas. But when British colonialism came to North America with these peculiar characteristics of the Puritan ideology settling in, with it, with two centuries of settler colonialism, they developed this idea of ownership. And I think it was really, it went from owning human beings to the idea of owning the land, not the reverse, of private property in human bodies and in land. Because it was almost unimaginable before. There was control of territories. There was enclosure of the commons, of course, was the preliminary step to that. But in the Americas, it took the turn of, you know, creating this idea of real estate and cutting everything into these rectangular plots of 160 acres and sections. And in the Northwest Ordinance, which preceded the Constitution during the War of Independence that created the United States, they actually mapped out. They had been doing surveying. George Washington was a surveyor, and you have to ask, why was such a wealthy, super wealthy planter a lowly surveyor? But surveyors got to choose the best land, you know, and mark it up. And they had already developed this plat, you know, this idea of creating territories and that would then become states once they had a majority settler population. That's why it took so long for Oklahoma. Oklahoma was the 47th state, New Mexico, Arizona, these places that had a majority native population until they could get enough settlers there. That's why I think they'll never allow Puerto Rico to be a state, even if Puerto Ricans wished it, which I don't think they do.
We're speaking with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, who's written an Indigenous People's History of the United States. I just want to read what the great scholar Robin Kelly said about the book for all you out there. Professor Kelly wrote, "This may be the most important U.S. history book you will read in your lifetime." Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz radically reframes U.S. history, destroying all foundation myths to reveal a brutal settler colonial structure and ideology designed to cover its bloody tracks. Here, rendered in honest, often poetic words, is the story of those tracks and the people who survived, bloodied but unbowed. Spoiler alert, the colonial era is still here, and so are the Indians. Roxanne, you're part Indian. I wanted to ask you how you came to this point, growing up poor in Oklahoma, embracing your Indian past and becoming the scholar you are. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I didn't embrace my my mother's heritage because she didn't. I always say my mother was marrying up when she married my father, who was a sharecropper, you know, so white sharecropper. It was rough being, you know, native in the United States. It still is, unless you're, you know, more privileged. But a lot has changed with the native movements. There's respect and there's kind of wannabe, but no one was a wannabe back then. I grew up in Canadian County, Oklahoma. My dad sharecropped and was a tenant farmer throughout that area until, you know, the Depression wiped out. The people went to California as refugees, you know, the story, the really poor. They weren't the really poor. They were the farmers who owned land that my dad used to say, we didn't have enough money to go to California. We were too poor. But it did throw all the tenants and sharecroppers, many of whom were black. They were black, white, and Indian sharecroppers off the land into, you know, jobs. So I got to know settler culture very well without being conscious that that's what it was until later. So later when I was sort of drafted into the American Indian Movement, recruited because I was part Indian, and I was doing, you know, promoting ethnic studies and Native American studies as a historian. I'm very cautious about the identity because Native nationalism, you know, it goes by, you know, Cherokee or Onondaga or Shawnee, Creek, Muscogee. And my mother was an orphan. There are many, many people who were, of course, refugees and orphans and on the frontier and really, really sad situation. My mother grew up as a street kid, and then she was put into an Indian juvenile facility run by the Southern Baptists. So she became a very hardcore Southern Baptist, and I was raised hardcore Southern Baptist. But on my father's side, my grandfather had been active in the labor movement. He was in Oklahoma. He was a socialist in the Socialist Party, and he was in a Wobbly. He was in. He named my father, who was born in 1907. He named him Moyer Haywood Scarberry Pettibone Dunbar. And so I heard these stories because of the name. I say, now, how did you get your name? And he would tell me about his father fighting the Ku Klux Klan and the big wheat farmers and the mining companies. Because Oklahoma is very industrialized, petroleum, mining, and agribusiness, wheat. Went from cotton fields to wheat, which was from the onset mostly mechanized. So the Wobblies organized mainly the migrant workers, and the Socialist Party in Oklahoma organized mainly the tenant farmers and the sharecroppers. And there was an instance in 1917 that I think is one of the most important moments in U.S. history, and hardly anyone knows about it. Jack Womack and I have written about it in Monthly Review. It was the Green Corn Rebellion. And this was where tenant farmers and sharecroppers, Native American, mostly Muscogee, Creek, African American, and white, rose up together against conscription. They had learned enough. They were mostly illiterate, but they had learned enough from the Socialist Party being there and being so active, and the Wobblies, to call this a rich man's war, imperialism. Of course, they were dependent on their young men to work, to feed the family, you know, the taking them away. I mean, they had a material self-interest, but they also had this idea of fighting conscription. Of course, they were defeated, but to me, it's like the uprising in Chiapas, you know, that global and local thing, and very few people know about it. I've done quite a lot of writing. I have a kind of split personality because I'm half settler and, you know, half native. That's why I wanted to do this book, because it's an indigenous people's history of the United States, you know, where I could bring the conscious, my knowledge of the kind of how the settler is screwed too, you know, and how important it is too. I find in Oklahoma with the young people who are children of settlers or, you know, descendants of original settlers, that they are so excited when they learn the truth of their own history. They don't feel guilt, you know, they feel excited, liberated.
Roxanne, you mentioned in your book that indigenous people offer possibilities for life after empire. Can you talk about what that might look like, how that process would unfold?
Well, I could read this last paragraph, which is the future.
We wish you would.
Yes, thanks. How then can U.S. society come to terms with its past? How can it acknowledge responsibility? The late Native historian Jack Forbes always stressed that while living persons are not responsible for what their ancestors did, they are responsible for the society they live in, which is a product of that past. Assuming this responsibility provides a means of survival and liberation. Everyone and everything in the world is affected, for the most part negatively, by U.S. dominance and intervention, often violently through direct military means or through proxies. It is an urgent concern. Historian and teacher Juan Gomez Quiñones writes, quote, American Indian ancestries and heritages ought to be integral to K-12 curriculums and university explorations and graduate expositions, with full integration of Native American histories and cultures into academic curriculums. Gomez Quiñones coins a measure of intelligence in the United States, the indigenous quotient. Indigenous peoples offer possibilities for life after empire, possibilities that neither erase the crimes of colonialism nor require the disappearance of the original peoples colonized under the guise of including them as individuals. That process rightly starts by honoring the treaties the United States made with indigenous nations, by restoring all sacred sites, starting with the Black Hills and including most federally held parks and land, and all stolen sacred items and body parts, and by payment of sufficient reparations for the reconstruction and expansion of Native nations. In the process, the continent will be radically reconfigured, physically and psychologically, for the future to be realized. It will require extensive education programs and full support and active participation of the descendants of settlers, enslaved Africans, and colonized Mexicans, as well as immigrant populations. In the words of Acoma poet Simon Ortiz, the future will not be mad with loss and waste, though the memory will be there. Eyes will become kind and deep, and the bones of this nation will mend after the revolution.
Roxanne, you wrote a particularly striking paragraph towards the end of your book on the United States' legacy of settler colonialism. I wonder if you would read it for us.
Yes, I write, in the United States, the legacy of settler colonialism can be seen in the endless wars of aggression and occupation, the trillions spent on war machinery, military bases, and personnel instead of social services and quality public education, the gross profits of corporations, each of which has greater resources and funds than more than half the countries in the world, yet pay minimal taxes and provide few jobs for U.S. citizens, the repression of generation after generation of activists who seek to change the system, the incarceration of the poor, particularly descendants of enslaved Africans, the individualism carefully inculcated that on the one hand produces self-blame for personal failure and on the other exalts ruthless dog-eat-dog competition for possible success, even though it rarely results, and the high rates of suicide, drug abuse, alcoholism, sexual violence against women and children, homelessness, dropping out of school, and gun violence. These are symptoms, and there are many more, of a deeply troubled society, and they are not new.
As we draw to a close, it might be useful to let our listeners know some of the ideas that you mentioned in your book for how we could get beyond empire. And you mentioned start by honoring treaties. What else can we do?
Well, the treaties are really important to most Native peoples. We include treaties and agreements because those who don't have formal treaties have de facto agreements with the United States just because of United States policy kind of homogenizing everything. These treaties of, they go back even to the colonial era, but the treaties of peace and friendship, in particular in the plains and the west, west to the Rocky Mountains and then over the Rockies in between the Sierra and the Rockies, the inner mountain west and the plains. These people were resisting fiercely and only they didn't surrender, but they agreed to peace agreements that were very strongly negotiated by the Native people to retain a land bases large enough, their kind of buffalo, because they were people of the bison. After these treaties were made, 1864, 1868, following the U.S. Civil War, the United States proceeded to systematically wipe out the bison, the food fight, as they had just, burned the crops of the farming people, these nomadic people. They destroyed their life sustenance, their food supply, the bison. They had the army coming out and actually murdering the buffalo. 90 million bison killed within about 6-year period of time. They used to, for people riding on trains, so they would give everyone a rifle to shoot out the window. They're large targets, the bison, and they were practically tamed by the Native people, attracted by, various means to gather around people, and they were, considered a gift from the gods for the for many Native people. This then led to starvation, deprivation, the reservation system, and the eating away, the illegal taking of land that was guaranteed under the treaties. So you had very much like Israel, taking pieces of land here and there in the occupation. You had this great Sioux Nation, for instance, that covered most of North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Montana, and to Minnesota, all contiguous, all one people. And it was broken down into 9 very small reservations, very impoverished, which it is today. So the reconstitution of those land bases and creating life estates for the settler descendants, the government can pay them off. Say, okay, when this generation is gone, this goes back to the Native people, and you will get this sum of money. That's how these things are done, So it's absolutely doable. These are fairly sparsely populated places. There's a guarantee in legislation under the New Deal, what was called the Indian New Deal, that reconstituted Native governments in 1934, the Indian Reorganization Act, that the United States was obligated to any land that contiguous to any reservation that came up for sale, that the United States had to buy it for and put it in trust for the Native nation. They did that in a very few cases early on, but then with the reactionary 50s, they stopped doing that and did the opposite. And then Congress passed the Termination Act. It was actually called that, Indian Termination, to do away with all land bases. Well, this created a huge revolt among Native people, and they stopped that. but several Native nations were terminated and had to fight for their reconstitution. That is the main demand. Land base, nationhood, the ability to prosper and exist as people, you know, not just individuals being assimilated out. That's another form of genocide, you know, of disappearing people, even in the Genocide Convention, creating conditions that eliminate people as a people, not just individuals.
Well, we've been talking with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, whose new book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, is published by Beacon Press, a very, very important history. Please read it. Roxanne, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
An insightful book. Thank you, Roxanne.
Thank you both.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
After the September 11, 2001 attacks, the New York City Police Department created a vast and covert surveillance program targeting Muslim American communities in New York, New Jersey, and beyond. The federal lawsuit, Hassan v. City of New York, challenges the constitutionality of this program. The original complaint was filed by Muslim advocates in the District Court of New Jersey. Later, it was joined by the Center for Constitutional Rights. The lawsuit seeks an end to the program and destruction of any records gathered. Zaima Abdul Rahim was surveyed by the NYPD because she operates a grade school for Muslim girls. Police officers recorded details about the school, such as the fact that she ran it from her home and that its students were mostly African American. As the Associated Press reported in an award-winning series, the NYPD monitored and/or infiltrated nearly every aspect of Muslim life, from mosques and student associations to halal butcher shops, restaurants, and private citizens. Internal police documents confirm that the program produced zero leads to terrorist activity, and it was in operation for one full decade. Here to discuss a recent court decision in the case is Geeta Schwartz, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. She works on racial justice, immigrants' rights, and government misconduct cases. Geeta, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Your client, Geeta, Zaima Abdul Rahim, was surveyed by the NYPD because she operates a grade school for Muslim girls. Mm-hmm. Tell us what the police discovered and what links, if any, existed to criminal activity.
Ms. Abdul Rahim's school was surveilled as part of a widespread program by the NYPD to surveil Muslims in the metropolitan New York area and actually beyond. And her school, which is a religious school for girls, was among the many, many, many Muslim-affiliated institutions, stores, school associations, university students, individuals, mosques that were surveilled as part of this program. And her school, as well as all of the other plaintiffs who were surveilled in this case, didn't yield any leads at all. In fact, in more than a decade of this program operating, literally zero leads were unearthed through this widespread dragnet surveillance program.
Now, how did it work that there was monitoring within the school? Were there undercover operatives, or what kind of information was sort of transmitted to the police department?
Well, the program itself, the information that we currently have as a result of some of the reporting on the Muslim surveillance program is that the school was among many other institutions and groups that were sort of placed on a map and noted. The actual details of the very specific details of what the NYP did to each of the plaintiffs, while we know generally what they did, that's something that we are looking forward to finding out about in discovery. And part of the way this case worked is that, you know, we've had significant information about the program and who was targeted and who ended up in the NYPD's files. But the very specific details about individual actions that NYPD employees took, that the NYPD did as a whole, that's the kind of thing that comes out when you're in discovery and going forward with your case.
How did you actually learn about the existence of the surveillance program? Was it through the Associated Press reports, or was it prior to that?
That's an interesting question. The formal details of the mapping project, that came out through the Associated Press reports that began in 2011. But that's not to say that many of our plaintiffs didn't already, that there wasn't already a sense in the Muslim community that something like this was going on. So I'd have to say that the way that the formal program was sort of released to the public, that was through the Associated Press. Following the Associated Press's revelations, the Bloomberg administration and then Commissioner of the NYPD, Raven Kelly, did quite a bit of press supporting the program and justifying what they were doing. But the formal mapping element of the program came out largely through the Associated Press.
What do you mean when you refer to mapping?
Well, the NYPD undertook this very grand project to label, name, and make notes on a large variety of Muslim-affiliated institutions, not just mosques, but retail stores, not just religious schools, but Muslim student associations. They sort of set up this large project to document where everyone was. And part of the mapping project, it was vastly inclusive, but it also made a lot of very specific exclusions. For example, all Muslims in a specific area were to be sort of noted, surveilled. We need to know where they are. But Egyptians who may be Coptic Christians, we don't have to note them. Iranians, people of Iranian descent who may be Jewish, we don't need to know about them. So the mapping project was literally a sort of information gathering project, just to sort of figure out where is the Muslim community and who are the individuals and individual institutions within the Muslim community.
Have you ever heard of any program like this elsewhere in the country, where a particular community is chosen for such mapping, absent any suspicion of criminal activity being afoot?
Well, programs like this have existed in our history, whether they're done via local law enforcement or federal law enforcement. I think the actual sort of phrase mapping, I'm not sure of an exact analogy, but, you know, one of the principles in our case is that when things like this happen, they are considered to call up constitutional questions. So, for example, if a bank decides it's going to photograph every black person walking in and out of the bank, you know, irrespective of suspicion of specific wrongdoing, that's something that's going to give rise to a question about whether that's constitutional and whether that's discriminatory. So to say that there's an exact analogy of another local police force doing this, I'm not sure that we know something with these exact details, but it's certainly not an unprecedented type of action that law enforcement takes when crime or national security is used as the justification.
It seems to me that such an endeavor would require really a vast expansion of existing personnel and other resources within the NYPD. Did they create a new or separate unit to oversee this project?
Yes. The NYPD created a demographics unit. Sometime in the middle of it, they changed the name to the Zone Assessment Unit. So they actually created a full unit of personnel devoted to this activity. And while the new, I guess not so new, de Blasio administration says that the unit it has been disbanded, there's been zero indication that the actual activities of these personnel have stopped.
Give us a brief procedural history of the case. I understand that it was actually brought initially by the organization Muslim Advocates in District Court of New Jersey, and then CCR joined on. You've had a recent decision. Tell us how we got to where we are and what that decision was.
The case was brought exactly in the District Court of New Jersey on behalf of people in New Jersey who had been surveilled in this way, who had shown up in some of the documents that were leaked by people within the NYPD and published in the Associated Press. And there's actually a parallel case that was brought in New York on behalf of residents of New York City who had similar injuries. And the case went before Judge Martini in the District Court of New Jersey, and the city, rather than answer the complaint, filed a motion to dismiss, saying a number of things. One, that we didn't have standing, meaning we weren't actually harmed, that the harms that we listed didn't give rise to a way that a judicial forum could address. Two, even if our plaintiffs were harmed, their harm was caused not by the city's program, but by the Associated Press's publication of their names and the details about the program.
Huh, interesting.
And so those were sort of the main sort of standing arguments the city used. And they also said that our complaint, which alleged discrimination based on religious affiliation, that was we had quite a bit of harms that our plaintiffs alleged, including people stopped coming to their stores, mosques stopped having the same levels of attendance, so they weren't able to get contributions in the same way. An important part of our standing claim was that the discrimination in and of itself caused a significant harm to our plaintiffs because it was the state conferring upon Muslims or people affiliated with Muslim institutions an inferior status.
Mm-hmm.
And the city's argument was that in addition to our plaintiffs not having been harmed or having been harmed not by the city but by the Associated Press, is that you can't say it's discrimination if there's actually an alternative reason for the city having done what it did. And the city said it wasn't that we were discriminating against Muslims, it's that we were trying to investigate, root out, learn more about possible terrorist activity.
And yet they weren't engaging in the same kind of mapping in other communities across the city.
That's exactly right. It was very specifically focused on the Muslim community.
Didn't they have a program in CUNY or at one of the city universities where they were doing this as well?
Well, part of the mapping included spying on student associations, Muslim
right.
student associations. I mean, that was a very active part of the program.
Yeah.
So you can imagine that university students who are sort of meeting in a group to sort of meet other people from their community, discuss a range of issues that might be relevant to Muslim students or to students in general, there was this sense that even those kinds of meetings and affiliations were unsafe and could be targeted and surveilled.
I know friends who teach at CUNY and who were horrified when these revelations came out. It goes so against the grain of what an educational environment is supposed to be like in terms of fostering free debate and has really a chilling effect on association.
That's absolutely right.
Where's the case going now?
In the district court, the city's arguments won the day. In a 10-page ruling, the district court judge dismissed our claims. He actually adopted the city's argument that it's not discrimination against Muslims if you're really looking for terrorists, which it seems sort of paradoxical because, of course, if you're labeling all Muslims as potential terrorists, that is, of course, a discriminatory classification and categorization. But that's how the district court judge ruled. So our plaintiffs appealed to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and the district court judge's opinion was overturned. The Third Circuit issued a lengthy and really very moving and eloquent decision rejecting the city's stance that counterterrorism somehow justifies labeling the entire Muslim community as potential criminals. And it's really a very interesting decision. First, it very clearly states that just the fact of being discriminated against, just the fact of being labeled as a potentially different, inferior group, that in of itself is a harm that courts can address. So while our plaintiffs allege a number of injuries, including restricting their religious attendance, losing business, things that are sort of more standard and typical. In typical cases, the harm of being discriminated against in and of itself is a harm that the courts find cognizable. So that's a very interesting and, in our view, very good and important way of viewing discriminatory classifications.
I think that's a remarkable finding. I mean, that can apply in so many of these politically charged cases where one of the elements, especially in so-called national security cases, is the stigmatization, labeling, vilifying, and then treating differently groups of individuals.
That's exactly right.
Is this being remanded?
Yes, it's been remanded to the district court for the typical proceedings that one goes through when one is going to be proving one's case. So we will be entering into discovery and working on all the things we need to prove about our case. The way we framed it and the way the Third Circuit Court of Appeals framed it is where there is a discriminatory classification, as there is here or as we plausibly alleged here, that program, that discriminatory classification, has to withstand, you know, very heightened constitutional scrutiny to survive. So there really needs to be, if in fact this discriminatory classification existed, the city really needs to justify it under very, very, very strict circumstances. And we feel confident that it will be very difficult for the city to show that a classification that included spying on a children's school, looking at typical businesses, going into student associations, we don't believe that the city's program is going to survive that scrutiny.
In fact, they permeated every aspect of really mundane daily lives.
That's exactly right. And it caused really a very significant chilling effect on people attending the mosques that were spied on, mm-hmm. on people going to university meetings, I mean, going to stores to buy meat for your family. I mean,
right.
Every single aspect of community life was up for grabs.
How many plaintiffs are in the case?
Well, you know, we have a couple of we have a few institutional plaintiffs, so it just sort of depends on how you count it. Based on how we frame the complaint, we have 10 individual plaintiffs, appellants, but within that, we have the Council of Imams in New Jersey, which encompasses a number of mosques in northern New Jersey. We have, a number of people who attended mosques that were sort of targeted by the NYPD. So the community that's sort of affected by this and the community encompassed by the number of plaintiffs that we have is really rather large.
You had strong community support in terms of getting the word out about this case?
We think so. We've had, I should have said we have 11 plaintiffs,
okay.
Institutional and individual plaintiffs, not 10. We've had quite a lot of support from the Newark area, northern New Jersey area. There's been an enormous amount of interest in our case. People really see the links between targeting Muslims and justifying it by counterterrorism motives, and the way that the stop and frisk litigation in New York City, you know, was the stop and frisk policy in New York City was justified by fighting crime. There's really been an enormous amount of interest in those linkages. And at Rutgers, where a couple of the Muslim Student Association students, the Muslim Student Associations in Rutgers have been also very supportive and very interested in learning about our case. And so we feel that the community support has really been great. And there's an enormous amount of activity in New York City itself among people who have been similarly affected by the NYPD's program here.
Geeta, in our couple of remaining minutes, I note that among the cases you focus on at CCR, you handle government misconduct. We wanted to get an update on the Vulcan Society v. City of New York case because we've covered that over the years, challenging employment discrimination by the New York Fire Department. What's happening in the case right now?
As you may know, the case, the claims process of the case and this was completely settled recently, and all the claims to the people who were discriminated against by the FDNY when during the application process have been paid out. So that's been a really great thing for the almost 1,500 claimants who suffered discrimination, Black and Latino claimants who suffered discrimination, either because they weren't hired by the FDNY or were hired very untimely by the FDNY. So that part of the case is basically complete, and the parties are moving forward to continue the remedial process that was ordered by the court in 2012 so that we can monitor how hiring goes in the future, make sure that the next test for FDNY applicants is a fair test, ensure that the processes for dealing with discrimination complaints within the FDNY is fair and improved, and a number of other areas that were either part of what the court ordered initially or what the parties agreed to in settlement. So it's been a very positive, productive process. The FDNY is bringing in the most diverse classes it's ever had in its history, so we're really very happy with how that is going.
Well, in the work that you do, which is often so challenging in these kinds of cases, it must be especially rewarding to have not only those positive remedial measures taken in Vulcan Society, as well as the recent decision in Hassan. Congratulations.
Well, thank you so much. I think one of the things that was really very moving about the Hassan decision is that it really linked the issues in Hassan of discrimination against Muslims to so many other eras of discrimination by the government against other minorities or targets. So one of the really wonderful things that the court did was say, this is no different. Muslim surveillance of Muslims because they are affiliated with Islam is no different from surveilling African Americans who are active in the civil rights movement, is no different from targeting Jews who are active in dissent against the government during the Red Scare era, is no different from how Japanese Americans were treated during World War II. It really sort of linked all these issues in a very fruitful and positive way. And so it does seem like working on a case about discrimination against African Americans by the FDNY, it couldn't be more different from a case of the NYPD surveilling Muslims, but they really are very linked, and that's one of the really wonderful things about the victory in Hassan.
Geeta Schwartz, it's been a true pleasure to have you on today. We hope to stay in touch with you in the future about other positive developments.
Great. I would love to be on again, too.
Best of luck.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Met each other this morning for a reason. Thinking, talking, we've worked out our problems. Look like we should have better days in front. Just because we took our time to think and talk for a much better understanding.